This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Like so many of us, Wesley Hogan loved listening to stories when she was young. She was particularly fond of the stories her grandfather told. She knew that if she finished her homework early, she could sit at his knee and hear tales from his own childhood. They developed a close bond, but that bond was tested when she asked her grandfather about America's use of atomic weapons. His response changed the way she thought about storytelling. Her desire to understand stories and what they can tell us about the world ultimately led her to the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University. She became the director this summer and joins us in the studio now, Wesley Hogan. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Good to be here.
So tell us more about this, about your grandfather's stories and how eager you were to hear them.
Well, the story began on the, he had been a very young man, a lieutenant in the Navy in the Pacific during World War II, and so I didn't know that part of him at all. I met him when he was in his mid-50s, and every day after school came home. But what happened one day was I came home from school, and I said in a very stern manner, we shouldn't have dropped the atomic bomb. And he got very upset, which was not his usual demeanor, and thus began my fascination with his military past. So I began to ask him questions, which he was very reluctant to answer, which wasn't usually the case. Mm-hmm. And so I learned about multiple points of view, right? So learning from my teacher why Hiroshima was a human catastrophe, and then hearing about his very strong belief that we wouldn't have had a family. He wouldn't have been able to come home and have a family had it not been for Truman's decision. So I began to grow fascinated with hearing from different points of view, the same story from different points of view. And as I went through high school in particular, learned how to ask questions.
So this is fascinating at a lot of levels. I mean, number one, he's been telling you stories, and did those stories include personal stories, stories of his own life?
Reluctantly.
Yeah.
I mean, mostly they were stories about other people that he'd encountered, and he was very funny. Mm-hmm. But quickly, especially after the Hiroshima debate, grew to include more serious political topics, and he and I had very different political views, and so he would often illustrate his point with an anecdote. And I found this very effective and hard to refute. I learned from him how to do that.
And of course, his story was when he finally, you come home glibly, you know, sort of spreading this thing, not assuming that he's going to agree with you, right?
I totally thought he would agree with me, that we had the same preeminent value of preserving human life. Mm-hmm.
But his story was, like many, many, many people, particularly those who served in the Pacific, they had been told, I mean, we have since learned otherwise, but they had been told of the catastrophic loss of human life, American life in particular, had we not dropped the bomb.
Right.
So he tells you that story. And you begin to think, it's interesting. So did you get angry at that point, or did you wonder all of a sudden, well, wait a minute, how could this man?
Yeah, I was pretty young. I think I was in fourth grade. But I went back to my teacher the next day and said, I'm not sure this is true. And of course, this was in a classroom where the teacher earlier in the year, I'm left-handed, and the teacher had tied my left hand behind the desk. So she was not particularly open to multiple points of view. But so we had a shutdown situation. But that, you know, made me even more curious to know what were third, fourth, fifth points of view.
Right.
And so as a young person, I grew fascinated not only with history, but in finding different perspectives, and particularly marginal perspectives, perspectives that might not be in the textbooks that I was exposed to, and sought out those people, the ones who are good at asking questions and the ones who were telling me a story that maybe I hadn't heard before.
When did this curiosity about multiple points of view blossom into a desire to become a historian?
I was an undergraduate, and I was involved in the anti-apartheid movement on campus and also in a rape crisis center. And both had very laudable goals. So one quite obvious, and the other, the rape crisis center, was trying to promote or lessen gender violence inside those nonprofits, or nonprofit in one case and social movement on the other. Things were kind of a mess. And people weren't being very kind to each other. And so this was driving people out of the movement in one case and the nonprofit in the other. And so I thought, this is kind of crazy. I really agree with these perspectives, but don't want to work here and don't want to stay here. Somebody must have done this before me. I don't want to reinvent the wheel. And so I spent a couple years bartending, trying to figure out what I wanted to do, and finally decided, with the help of some very impressive people from my undergraduate institution to go back and figure out what people had done in the 60s in similar situations inside of those social movements. And so then I began to do a lot of interviewing of former activists.
And that is the center of your, most of your work is on the civil rights movement in the 60s.
Yeah. So I did some work on the women's movement, and then they moved me back and said we learned what we knew from the civil rights activists. And so I began to talk to civil rights activists from the earliest part of the youth movement, so the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC. And those people I interviewed for about 10 years. Over the course of 10 years, did about 150 interviews. And each time I thought, there can't be a more amazing person than the person I just interviewed. And they'd redirect me to the next person who, of course, right, blew my hair back again. So I learned an enormous amount of knowledge existed outside of the university setting. And it was sort of the same situation as my fourth grade teacher. When I came back to the university, there was some consternation about to what degree these people were authorities. And so I grew, again, interested in the dialectic between knowledge that is sanctioned and knowledge that is unsanctioned, and the connection, you know, what can we learn from unsanctioned questions and knowledge?
What's an unsanctioned question? What do you mean by that?
So a lot of the questions that I was asking about the inside of social movements were not particularly they weren't frequently asked by scholars of the civil rights movement. They were more interested in looking at the confrontation between white supremacy and the civil rights activists, or, you know, what was the role of the Kennedy or Johnson or Nixon administration in regards to the movement. And that, while important, and I'm really glad there are other people doing that work, wasn't so compelling to me. Again, I think movements only are powerful to the degree to which they can keep people inside them and continue to recruit. And if you're having very bad experiences inside the movement, you can't continue to recruit and keep people.
And yet it's fascinating because we know there were enormous conflicts within SNCC, then between SNCC and the SCLC. I mean, monumental questions and conflicts about how to proceed, whether to include young people or not, whether to include women or not, whether it should be bottom up or top down. All these are critical questions for a movement that had very little time to work these things out.
Absolutely. And I think there's some real power in exploring them now. I think people for a long time were a little nervous to explore them because they felt like it was airing dirty laundry. And to some degree, there's still that concern. Especially for young people now that are looking to learn from those movements, I think there's a huge amount of eagerness to understand how people worked out conflicts, how people decided how to move forward tactically and strategically. What do you do if one half of your group wants to go in one direction and the other move towards another? And so there was a great deal for me of personal interest and satisfaction in learning these things, although I will say that I am a little less, not hopeful, that's the wrong word, but a little less sure that history can point us in positive directions. I've learned a lot personally, and I've been able to share some of those stories with others, but I think we need more than history as we, you know, continue to find ways forward.
One of the fun things about me for history has always been, or had always been, the ability to kind of sum it up. Like if I learned enough details and found enough good things, discovered many surprises along the way, things that overturned my pre-existing prejudice, I could then say, aha, it happened because of this. So now I've gotten to the point where I just have given up on that, that to me is not a goal. But it does leave me in this funny place, and I wonder if there's anything instructive in that. Is the goal of history to allow us to tell a story, or can we really just go forward with multiple oral and written histories and say, those are the things that happened in that 10-year span?
Okay, so Frank, I'm not going to try to take on the mantle of answering what the point of all of history is.
Why do you study this? Why bother?
But I will say for me, I'll just speak personally. I think it really matters to not only give people a sense of context, what's come before, how we fit into what's come before, but also to give people less surety. I think actually promoting questions and asking people to think in a curious way, why are we like this today? Where did this come from? Can actually open up a lot of new possibilities. And this is, for me right now, an incredibly valuable perspective to be okay with the fact that my grandfather and many others would have had, you know, millions of points of view on Hiroshima. I used to be extremely uncomfortable with that. I wanted one point of view, and I wanted a master narrative, right? And I think that getting people comfortable with the fact that there are multiple strands of thinking is extremely powerful in itself and can lead to a lot of interesting creative solutions to problems that linear thinking doesn't allow.
I heard a mathematician over this weekend who tried to take down the question. The question was, why bother? Well, you know, why should we study math? He said, look, we shouldn't. There's no should involved. Why should we watch Michael Jordan play basketball? Why should you enjoy Shakespeare? You shouldn't. But your life is a lot richer with it. It's beautiful. So study it and enjoy it. But I think what you say is important too. Learning these, and there's research too that suggests that conflict resolution has a lot to do with everybody dropping their single narrative and just hearing what other people involved in that conflict feel about it. Then you don't have to lose your narrative, but it turns out that, the grandfather you love thinks very differently about an important issue.
Yeah, and learning how to disagree with someone and still get work to work tomorrow and do something together, I think, is incredibly powerful. One of the things that also is surprising about studying the civil rights movement, I think, is how many people were very ambivalent. And so this occurred to me when I was watching this movie about Hannah Arendt over the weekend, and she was dealing with the same thing in terms of the resistance to the Nazis. But, of course, in the civil rights movement, there are lots and lots of people who are afraid to act, particularly whites in the South. And so I interviewed one woman an African-American woman who was in jail in Danville, Virginia. And she talked about how when she got to jail, and they were there for 4 days and they had no access to change of clothes. And so one day the jail warden brought in a bunch of new dresses, and they'd all been made by white women in the town. And sewn into the hem of the dresses was either like a dollar bill or a note saying, we're with you, we just can't admit it publicly. And this was incredibly empowering for her.
We're going to take a break talking to Wesley Hogan, the new director of the Center for Documentary Studies. Stay tuned to The State of Things. This is The State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio talking with Wesley Hogan, the new director of the Center, relatively new director of the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University. You were telling a story just before the break about the civil rights movement. Maybe you can recap the story and take it forward.
Right. So this was a woman who had been involved in Danville, Virginia, in the civil rights struggle. She was an African-American woman, very young, 18 years old when she was arrested in 1963. She was in jail for 4 days. Some women brought dresses in for the women who'd been arrested, and the warden brought them in and sort of threw them at the women in jail. And this woman remembered not just picking up a dress that fit, but also finding in the hem a note that said, we're with you, our husbands forbid us being involved publicly, but we support what you're doing. So interestingly enough, she was telling this story much later, 4 decades later, and she noted how at the time she was surprised and joyful. So this is 1963. Later, she became involved in the Black Power movement and for a long period didn't talk to whites at all. But now, this interview took place about 10 years ago, had come to the sense that there was really much more ambiguity among both blacks and whites who participated participated in one side or the other. And she came back to this story as sort of embodying this tension between as humans, we like to think of all things as good and evil, right? And that she saw this as an act behind the scenes, quiet, but yet important to note. So that she found this an incredibly important way to think about the movement going forward, that it was, of course, her as a young person standing up, acting as if segregation did not exist, that made a huge dent in the wall that was Jim Crow. But she had to acknowledge to herself and later to others that there were incredibly important roles that other people played as well. And that was an important and difficult thing. It still is, I think, for many people. When you look at a story, it's so much nicer to have a clear villain and a clear hero.
Well, and if it weren't for that note sewn in the hem of the dress, what other documentation would there be for those whose weak resistance, right, who didn't want to participate in this but didn't know how not to?
Exactly.
And what did it mean to have so much weak resistance, right, to this thing called Jim Crow? How important was that? Where's the documentation? So a historian's never going to find that story.
Oral historians will.
Oral historians will. So you came to Duke from Virginia State University, a historically black university. You co-directed the Center for Race Relations. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the Institute for Race Relations was formed in 1993. Virginia State is on a hillside. At the bottom of one side of the hill is a predominantly African-American community of Petersburg, and to the north of that is what used to be called a sundown town, where all African-Americans had to be out of town by sundown, Colonial Heights. And so we found ourselves in the middle of a very divided community. And so the Institute was formed as a community-university partnership to try to bring people together in different kinds of ways. We brought different kinds of scholars in, but we also brought community activists in. We brought Harvey Gantt in the 90s. And we tried to find ways and forums through which people could do some exploration of the racial history that the area shared, as well as the less successful but very intriguing process of reconciliation. And so that work ended, sadly, as a victim of the recession. And so in 2009, it closed. But I think in that time period, that 15-year time period, what was really exciting for me was to see different ways that people in the university could use the university as a pivot point to try to bring together people who otherwise might not come into contact or want to come into contact in a safe environment where these kinds of topics could be unearthed and examined and possibly moved to a different situation.
Now, it seems natural on the one hand. There's the university sort of geographically and physically located in the middle of these two communities and a place where this kind of study and research goes on. And yet it's not normal at all for universities to get this involved, would you say?
No, it was not. And it was not popular on campus. So we had some resistance. And particularly, I think I can speak now about this since our president isn't that the president has changed. Our president was quite skeptical of this initiative. However, I think we had some local foundations that were supportive and that moved things. And we also had some incidents in the community that prompted a lot of reflection and forced people to say, we need some kind of format or forum or place where we can look at these communities and why they've developed in these very specific ways. And particularly for young people, children in the K-12 systems on either side of the hill, they were actively asking for, we want some kind of facilitation of dialogue. And so the first initiatives of the Institute were actually in the K-12 system.
Oh, what were the incidents that prompted some of this thought?
Yeah. So both of the initial incidents are pretty ugly, but the one involved use of the N-word by a teacher in a very unfortunate situation, and the other involved a sports team, a football team that had experienced, this was on the African-American side, a sports team that had experienced a lot of racism when it traveled outside of the school district.
So what kind of programs and what did you do?
First, we started training college students as facilitators. This is 96% of the student body is African-American, and they come from a wide variety of experiences themselves. So some come from almost entirely black high schools. Others are international. We had a very large West African population. And then some came from Northern Virginia schools, which are much more integrated, predominantly white schools. And so we purposefully sought out students that had come from a variety of backgrounds and trained them as facilitators. We went into the high schools and did an overview. Here's what we're going to do today. And then we split the students up into groups of five each with one college facilitator. And they worked together on a certain set of questions around, in this case, it would be around the incident.
But do you address it head on? You're really talking about questions involving race relations?
We teach them how to talk about race in a safe way. I mean, I think the big thing that people are surprised by with this work is how little they in their own lives have had any kind of frank conversations about race, intra-racial as well as interracial. And so we just set ground rules for students initially and then for other groups later on. Faculty, we had a big initiative with our own faculty about how do we talk about these issues in a way that we can hear one another, much like what you said before. Oftentimes it's just listening to the other person's story and acknowledging it without necessarily agreeing that does a lot of the work for you.
And where did this, how did you know about this? How did you develop these plans?
I came in 2003, 10 years after the founding of the Institute. So it was well in place before I got there. But it was one of the things that got me to Virginia State. So I had been extremely interested in these questions, saw very few nonprofits or universities addressing them, and felt like this was incredibly important work to do.
Did you sense any result? Did you sense any movement?
In the communities at large, there was definitely movement. And in the K-12 systems on both sides of the hill, there was definitely movement. I do think it's continual, though. If the administrations change, or in one case, the police chief changed on the white side of town, changed, and we were able to meet with him and negotiate, they did an incredibly humiliating gauntlet for many of our students as they were coming in from the white side of town. And we were able to change that in large part because the personnel, the leadership of the local police department changed. So I would say that administration, of course, is going to change again. And so the importance is to keep some kind of institutional body active and involved, continually raising these questions, teaching people how to talk about it, and teaching them how to negotiate with power.
What about conversations within the group? We know that within each group, I mean, we know that, for instance, in sundown towns all over America, those have remained predominantly white to right. this day. And yet you wonder if there, how much sort of active conscious conversation there is about that within those communities, within African American communities too. We were just talking about that particular case. Or not. And so do you have to sort of raise it to the conscious level and then go back and bring people together or not? Do you just bring both groups together and say, look, what's going on here?
Well, unfortunately, these issues tend to be raised all too frequently on their own because of an incident. So the two things that I can say to that that immediately jump to mind are the Trayvon Martin case, which wasn't even a sundown town, but which is a gated residential community, raised this issue profoundly for people thinking about their own children. Would my child be profiled in this way? But also, in the case of Colonial Heights, many of our students took their cars to be repaired at a shop that had KKK memorabilia in its window, and yet said, we welcome VSU students, and we will accept the one card, which was the university debit card. And so students began to protest. And this man had been raised within a Klan family, five generations, and he had a very sort of not thought through process of talking about race. And so he was racist in the way that he talked, but he was a very open man in some respects. And so three or four students just figured out how to talk to him and began to campaign. And eventually it led to a 5-week boycott of the store, and he took down the paraphernalia. And so this is the kind of incident that I think people are very loath to approach and don't want to do it directly and just need some support and training in doing it. But once they have that, they can, I very much learned to trust in, you know, almost everyone's good-hearted response if they're given a safe environment with which to discuss these kinds of very difficult questions.
So was there a change in thinking? Because I always, you know, whenever you hear, I'm not a racist, but you know that racist but statement is going to follow. And so you think to yourself, well, that is an unexamined point of view because there's a level of sincerity in the I'm not a racist but preface, and yet you know what's going to follow. And so you think, well, all right, how do we examine this? And does examining those prejudices and those suppositions really involve a result in change?
I mean,
it's one thing to boycott the store and say, oh, I'm losing business, I'm going to take this stuff out of here, right? And quite another to say, oh, my goodness, yeah, I guess if I was standing where you're standing, that would sound pretty racist.
Okay, so on an individual level, I've definitely seen lots of examples of change. I think your larger point about structural change and can I see it is much more ambiguous. And I'll say the two things that have shocked me most about moving from Virginia to North Carolina are the state of education and the state of voting. And these are, of course, the two primary things that have been driving the freedom movement since the Civil War ended. So we can get back to that. But on an individual level, I have seen enormous amount, I mean, wonderful and heartbreaking stories of particularly white law enforcement during the 1960s, who now with the up, you know, that we've had since 55, the series of 50-year anniversaries, right? So this summer is going to be the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer in Mississippi. Mm-hmm. So one of the most brutal law enforcement officers in the state police of Mississippi has been very forthcoming that he regrets his behavior. And that is certainly encouraging. The structural components, though, I think are much more challenging.
You did a project, helped create the Petersburg Civil Rights History Community Project. Mm-hmm. What was that?
We did a math literacy initiative in the Petersburg schools, and this led to this Civil Rights History Project. So initially our task was just to raise the test scores of Algebra 1 students. To do that, though, we brought in the National Algebra Project, and that was led by Bob Moses, who'd been really involved in the Mississippi Civil Rights struggle. Out of that struggle, he decided that it wasn't just the vote, but he had to take on the state of what he called sharecropper education throughout the states, not just in the 11 southern states, but throughout the nation. And so we began to look at how do we raise the level of math literacy in Petersburg. In the course of bringing him in, he said, I was here in the 1960s. There was an amazing movement here. What do you know about it? And I'd been there all of a year at that point. And so I said, I don't know. And he said, well, you need to go find out. Mm-hmm. So I ran into a wonderful group of people who were willing to be community interviewers. So these were people who had been young, too young to be involved in the movement, but wanted to do something to resuscitate it. And so we trained them as community oral historians, and we got video cameras to the library, and people could check them out like they checked out books. And they went and interviewed people, and we put together a pamphlet, and we distributed it through the church network to about 5,000 people in Petersburg, and then throughout the state, because unfortunately, the high-stakes test in Virginia, everyone has to learn Virginia history in fourth grade, and of the 500 or so questions they asked children to prepare, I had a fourth grader at the time, and so only three of those questions were on African-American history in Virginia. Wow. So the K-12 system obviously taught to the test, and so we got that booklet distributed through all of the 50-plus districts in the state, and so our next goal is to try to change that proportion of total number of questions and African-American history questions asked.
Well, how do they do in algebra?
The algebra story is so exciting. So when I came in 2003, 11% of ninth graders were passing Algebra 1. And I didn't believe it. I thought it was a typo. Wow. Because, of course, that meant 89% of the kids weren't going to be college ready. Right. And so now in the last 3 years, they varied between about 72% and the highest was 91% were passing. So that's really exciting.
Well, what accounts for that? Because I didn't hear you talk about numbers in that project.
Yeah. So that it was a huge and exciting and complicated effort to bring together the university with the National Algebra Project, the K-12 system. We also had the State Department of Education in Virginia involved. And then we had a wonderful set of partners with the Community Foundation, Dominion Power. I'm missing one funder. The Cameron Foundation.
Yeah.
And so we had this wonderful set of people that came together and created a coalition that was able to retrain the way 3rd through 12th grade math teachers teach math.
And it was that no storytelling involved.
Okay, just no, come there up is with a story.
That doesn't sound simple, but it does sound like very direct.
There's a great story there. Well, I mean, most of us learn math by memorization, right?
Uh-huh, yeah.
And they tried to teach it conceptually, but you have to retrain the teachers because they, of course, were all taught by memorization. And so they would turn around and teach the kids by memorization. Mm-hmm. You memorize this formula, you plug it in, and it's kind of a you're lucky if you understand conceptually. Right. And so this changed with the Algebra Project's methodology.
You know, it's interesting because the allegory, the analogy there, it seems to me quite apt. I mean, on the one hand, we're talking about changing people's views, viewpoints, one person at a time. And yet there is this huge structural demand, huge structural incentive for dividing us, for keeping us divided, for keeping people powerless. So that because now we're seeing a wealth gap that has divided so radically, so few people benefit by this. If you can't keep people divided, it's going to be overturned. And so that you can see the incentive for division, right? So can we both teach conceptually and by rote? Can we go one at a time? Do we have time to work one at a time? Or how do you sort of – and will that overturn a system and make it more democratic and fair? Or do we have to approach it structurally and say, hey, this thing is broken from the top down?
I think a lot of people asked Bob this question when he was starting with the math literacy.
Bob Moses,
because he was so – it was such a departure for people. They thought, you know, why aren't you still working on the political system? And he said, I am working on the political system because if these kids can't get to college, they are totally locked out of the information economy as much as the person who couldn't vote was locked out of the political body. And so for him, he – took the point of view, and I think it's extremely valid that there are multiple approaches to the problem. He says, I'm putting my bucket down here. And then shockingly, I mean, this was so interesting to me. He had, when I first met him in the late 90s, he'd been doing the project since 82, and he had 10 projects going. And now there's 20, and there's this whole group of students that flock to him that want to do this kind of work, and teachers that are interested in sharing the methodology with other teachers. And so it very much functioned for him organically the same way that SNCC had, that people saw what SNCC was doing, got inspired, went home to their hometown, and began to act in similar ways. And so it was about modeling behavior that opened up either the body politic in the case of SNCC, or in the case of the Algebra Project, making sure that students not only felt like they could be a part of the economy, but demanded a place in the economy and in their education.
And changing the way we think is vital in so many ways. I mean, you point out that we hold such widely different points of view on things. You just take a look at the polling after the Trayvon Martin, for instance.
Exactly.
Which paralleled the O.J. Simpson case decades earlier,
right,
in terms of the way whites and blacks viewed the outcome. I think it was something like 80%,
right,
you know, depending on which side you're on. That's two whole nations of people who don't see the world the same way, who don't see their country the same way, I guess.
And I think that's really important to continue to question. So my approach to that would be to ask people, so when students would ask me, what do you make of that? Right, I would ask them, why don't you go ask people what they think of it and just get the conversation started? And I think that's really hard for people to do. They're scared and they stay within their own social networks and their own I think social media sometimes tends to exacerbate that. And so asking people to ask the question of why it is probably one of the most powerful tools we have. Did you want me to riff on that 80% in either direction? I would love to know what you thought, too, as that data came forward.
We're right up against a break on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. May just answer that. Wesley Hogan is the director of the Center for Documentary Studies, and our conversation continues in a moment. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking with Wesley Hogan, the director of the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University. So what do you make of that when we have 80% of the population, African-Americans polled, thinking, you know, one thing about the outcome in Trayvon, 80% of white Americans saying, you know, that it was perfectly all right. What do you make of that?
So as an oral historian, I would say this comes to me from learning how people experience the world and grow up. So unfortunately, since I was a kid, many more schools are now segregated in both directions. And so people are growing up increasingly in schools that are either predominantly white, predominantly Asian, predominantly Hispanic, or predominantly black. And this is just shaping so much of kids' thinking. They're not exposed to wide diversity, and that their school is like their community, and their community's leadership is looking like them. And so it doesn't surprise me at all that those numbers were what they were. If we had more environments that were multicultural and very diverse and where people talked about these issues in an open setting, I think you'd have a very different – you'd hear those kinds of multiple narratives often, and people would be able to ask questions more openly about, you know, what exactly transpired between Trayvon and George Zimmerman. And that kind of conversation right now just isn't possible in most people's day-to-day lives.
So what do you make of the comment? So I make this comment. These are two nations, and I'll just flatly make it. It's not even declarative. It's imperative. There are two nations when you see that kind of disparity in polling. That's a dangerous statement, right? I mean, you're starting to sound like an irresolvable class war. So that's a dangerous thing for me to say. On the other hand, if we didn't say it, if we didn't acknowledge that huge disparity, are we pretending that we're living in some grand democracy where everybody works hard and we all have the same opportunities?
Right. I think we have to proceed gingerly on both fronts. So you have to acknowledge the fact that, and if you look at the unemployment data and the education data and the wealth income data, these are all incredibly marked by racial disparities and terrifying for our nation's future. So if you think about all of the innovative scientists and creative engineers and thoughtful novelists that were missing because they're being subjected to really substandard education and lack of opportunities throughout their young adult life. So 14% unemployment for young African-American men is just completely unacceptable. To have 2.5 million people in prison is insane. So I think we have to address them and figure out ways to, as a society, how do we want to approach them? And very few people are doing that work. So I think it's important that you point it out and that you say it and that people have an opportunity to stand forward and say we need to address these issues in a profound way. On the other hand, I think it's important that we take the mission statement of the U.S. seriously. I'm still incredibly Pollyanna-ish enough to be moved by that goal. And I think we have to continually bring it forward and say, how are we doing?
You have a good example, I think, in the students at Virginia State who had to who had to wrestle with this very conflict more or less every day. Tell us about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So most of the students from Virginia State don't come from the areas south and west of Virginia State, which is in Petersburg along the 85-95 corridor. They come from New York State, Maryland. And so when they come down from a vacation or they're coming onto campus for the first time, they have to come through that sundown town. And the first year that I was there, I taught a class in African American history and asked what the local issues were and learned that every day, many, many students coming through off of 95, there's about 2 miles of road between 95 and the school, were stopped by police if they had a hoodie on instead of a suit. And so a lot of kids would joke around, the young men, that they that they had a suit and tie in their back car, in the back of their car, so that they, when they get off the highway, the first thing they do is put on the coat and tie so they wouldn't get stopped coming through to the university. This just seemed outrageous to me, and particularly exacerbated by the fact that I learned later that the then police chief would not meet with the university president to discuss the matter. So we came up with some different ways to approach that, and there was protest involved and there was negotiation involved and students actively, again, boycotting some of the businesses along that strip before things changed. But it took a long time.
But there is the essence of the paradox, right? On the one hand, these are students who live every weekend the drama
Correct.
Of racism, right? They see it and they know it. And whatever the police chief says, they know that this is racism. On the other hand, they're going to a university to get an education, to get a job in the United States of America because this is the land of opportunity.
Absolutely. And so trying to ask them to think about what that contradiction spells out for themselves and their communities and for us as a nation, I think is too much of a burden to ask them to take on. So while it was very exciting to me to be a part of that community and to learn some of the ways to encourage them to grow and figure out how to navigate that world themselves as young adults, I think the more important work that I can do as a white woman would be to, and has been, to work in white communities around these same kind of issues.
So how will that happen here at CDS and at Duke University, of all places?
Yeah, so CDS is a comparatively, it's an interesting spot for Duke. It's more open in some respects. Some people are very intimidated by the sort of gothic spires, right? And so CDS has, it's like a low-key house, and there's free parking, and it's kind of in between East and West Campus, although it's hidden away a little bit. But it does have sort of a lower level entry point. It's not quite as intimidating. However, it still is part of Duke. And so I think we need always continually to reach out. And so one of the things I'm most looking forward to is learning the communities that surround the institution and to try to figure out what are the issues that are most important to people there. How can we collaborate in a productive manner? I'm just beginning that research now and beginning to build those relationships. But I will say I'm really excited to see some of the work that's already going on in Durham.
Well, how do you think that the Center for Documentary Studies, is it uniquely situated, do you think, as an institution at Duke to do this kind of outreach?
I don't know about at Duke. It's uniquely situated nationwide. It's the only documentary center in the country that does all these different documentary forms under one roof. And it's really exciting to me to see the collaborative spirit and just the level of talent under one roof. So when people put their minds together on a specific project, there's an enormous wealth of both expertise and sort of content knowledge around different subject matters. And so it's been really powerful to me to imagine what kind of work we could do with communities that surround Duke University. However, I also think we interact with artistic communities, documentary communities, the wider academic communities that do documentary work. And so there's lots of different points of overlap. And I think that the promise for me is in this first year when I'm trying to explore these potential opportunities is to look for who wants to work with us, right? Who's excited, who wants to learn to tell the story, who needs a wider audience for their story. So the thing we do best is to collect stories and share them. And so that's what I'm going to be looking for, is trying to find people that want to work with us to tell their story.
Is there anything else that you or, well, I'll stick with CDS can do. I mean, on the one hand, it's one thing to document stories, untold mm-hmm. stories within a community so that people feel valued and they can hear and see their stories projected on a larger scale. That's a good thing. Anything else CDS can do to integrate the academy with the community? Or is that pretty much the role, do you think?
Well, the role that CDS plays most powerfully, And this is somewhat of a cliche, but you might agree with me that it's also incredibly powerful, which is that the shortest point between two people is a story. And in our day-to-day lives, we just don't have that much opportunity to hear one another's stories. And so there's two problems with that. One, it's a real problem to get somebody to trust you enough to tell you their story. And then two, how do you share it in an ethical way? And so I think those two things CDS has enormous wealth of experience with and then can disseminate in multiple mediums. So that's powerful in and of itself. But I also feel like it's a strong community connector that we learn to be more respectful and responsible towards each other when we know each other's stories. And so there's many projects that CDS has engaged that go beyond storytelling to try to figure out how do we build better relationships with people in the community. And in that particular manner, I think CDS plays a very strong role and should play a very strong role in the Triangle community.
When I think about documentaries, I think about documentaries as journalism. And then there's Duke, which I see as an academy. They both do research. There's academic research and journalistic research. What's the difference between the two?
So I don't know if there's a hard and firm line, and maybe we could have this be more of a discussion because I would love to hear your thoughts too. But I think it's important to consider that journalists are fighting every day with a different set of day-to-day realities than academicians. And so academicians have the pressure of publish or perish, right? They need to get peer-reviewed and they need to get this sort of long, it took me, I think, 7 years to publish my book, right? It's this long thing. And you have to put on a show day in and day out, right? So these are different imperatives and they put different kinds of pressures on people. And then there's the whole question of how do you get money to do the research in the first place and how wide and deep can your research be? And so I think academic investigation or documentary investigation can afford to take that longer approach, although I've seen some very exciting work journalistically by people who are doing long-form journalism. Who have found ways to support this. And I can't wait to see what Glenn Greenwald does with this bunch of money that he just got from the eBay guy to see what kind of investigative journalism he can pull off in that framework. So I think that there's different imperatives, but that they can oftentimes, and so they lead to different day-to-day realities. But I think there's extremely important protections that both journalists and academicians claim, First Amendment ones in particular, that are essential to our expansion of knowledge, to understanding what's going on with our government, in our societies, in our day-to-day lives, that both formats or both approaches serve. So I'd like to give you a more controversial answer that you could really sink your teeth into. But the bottom line is I think they're both actually in a state of enormous flux. And they're not going to look the same in 10 years, documentary or journalism.
It seems to me that if you had to oversimplify it, you would say that journalism is story-driven and and academic research is data-driven. I don't know how important stories are to academic research, but data is vital to journalism, and we all respect accurate data. But without the story, there is not going to be journalism. The story is what in which we envelop. So you could do a paper on how people resolve conflict and somehow manage the conflicting stories between loved ones, and you could write that paper. But when I get you to tell me the story about your grandfather sitting at your grandfather's knee in Hiroshima, more people are going to remember that story. So that's the theory of this particular kind of journalism. Would that degrade academic research if that became a more vital part or a higher priority?
Absolutely not. I think there's a place for narrow research that goes deep in all academic environments. However, unless it can get beyond that narrow, deep place and be shared with other academics and other publics, that it's really destined for the desk closet and it's never going to be serving an essential purpose to society. So you really need that story. You need somebody to help you tell the story of why your biological research or why your anthropological research is essential. And so I think there's an increasing interest. People are very hesitant because, as you pointed out, there's nothing rewarded in the tenure system if you're a good storyteller. However, students will tell you, right? And if you're trying to connect, this is how I got to be a passionate narrative storyteller, is I really wanted my students to understand SNCC. And they're like, we don't care. right? We don't know anything about these people. We don't care. And so we would tell them stories. Here's why this person is so important. And then they would want to know more of the data stuff. How did these people actually initiate the change? What were their conflicts? How did they come to resolve those conflicts? But none of it would have worked without that hook of the story. And so I think that that's also obvious to many, many researchers in the academic environment, is that unless they can communicate at least a kernel of that narrative, it's very difficult.
Right. So it may not communicate, but they might get tenure. So it seems to me that perhaps, right? I mean, if you write the book and it's published and peer reviewed and nobody else ever read it, you get tenure.
Right. But if you care a lot about your subject and you really want to share that with other people, then you're highly motivated. But you're right.
That's an individual. The system doesn't place that incentive there. That's highly, highly individual. So is that changing, do you think, in the academy? I see more evidence, but I'm looking for evidence of it. I'm looking for, and I find a more narrative-based medicine, and I find the examples of it, and it gives me the sense, because I'm looking for it, that in medicine and other, in the sciences in particular, narrative is more important, at least in some places.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of this is driven by neuroscience and some of the findings that people have recently made about how human beings understand the world around them and how it's biologically driven. And so I think you can look at neuroscience as a key interdisciplinary area where people are beginning to connect these narratives. We have to have a narrative in order to understand how the world functions. And so that's opening up some exciting areas. But I think in terms of your larger question about is there an incentive? We have some really very powerful and exciting models of administrators now at Duke who are encouraging and providing resources for people connecting with larger publics. However, the tenure system itself has stayed remarkably implacable in the last 10 years of the internet revolution, and is, while there's some excitement and really innovative sharing of scholarship going on through social media, right now the tenure system has remained fairly impervious.
So do you have a big project you're working on now or really looking forward to at CDS?
I do. Well, this coming year is an exciting year in general because we're doing some planning. What are we going to take on next? What's our big set of projects that we'd like to look at? So I got to keep that under my hat for a little bit until I get some more clarity from all of us together. But I do think it is an unbelievable resource that has yet to be fully tapped. And so I'm really looking forward to that. In my personal scholarship, I'm working on a biography of a woman who tried to sort of live her philosophy. She came out of the civil rights movement and went into the women's movement and the environmental movement and some other social movements. And so trying to actually see how her life played out by believing sort of in this radical equality has been a fascinating project.
We will stay tuned and have you back for all of that. Wesley, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks so much, Frank.
Wesley Hogan, Director of the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University. For more about CDS, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org. Thank you for listening. The State of Things is produced by Alex Granados, Laura Lee, Sean Wen, and Nicole Campbell. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Wadarski is sitting in today. Bryson Russell is our intern, and Brent Wolf is our news director. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.